You're listening to the Animation Addicts Podcast with the Rotoscopers, episode 153, The Road to El Dorado. It's tradigital gold.
This episode was brought to you by the patrons. That's right. To find out more about how you can get your favorite movie nominated, head on over to rotoscopers.com/Patreon.
Welcome to the Animation Addicts Podcast with the Rotoscopers, Disney, DreamWorks, Pixar, Don Bluth, and everything in between. I'm your host, Morgan Stradling, and I'm taking you on a magical adventure to a forgotten city of gold. And my sidekick is going to be Chelsea Robson. Say hello, give a bow, play your guitar, or play your thunder tube.
It's been a while. It's back, people. It's back.
It never went anywhere. It just didn't have anything to say. For those of you who are new to our show, the Animation Addicts Podcast is a podcast all about the wide world of animation. We talk about films past and present, and we're going, 17 years back in the... Which is crazy. This is nearly a 20-year-old film.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about DreamWorks' Road, The Road to El Dorado. But before we do that, this is a patron pick. So we do have patrons through Patreon who help support the show and keep it going. And I want to give a shout out to the newest patron, which is Bethany B.
Hey, Bethany.
Hello.
Welcome to the Roto Nation.
This episode is brought to you by a particular patron. It is a patron pick of Jason.
Hey, Jason.
So thank you, Jason. We are excited. His second movie. So the way the patrons go is they submit two picks in case the first one has already been done or maybe another patron right before them picked it, which does happen from time to time where we don't end up doing their first pick. We do their second pick. But his first pick was The Road to El Dorado. His second pick was DuckTales the Movie, Treasure of the Lost Lamp, which I'm like, yes, I would like to do all of those.
I know.
If you want to learn more about the perks of being a patron and consider being a patron yourself, go to rotoscopers.com/patron.
Look out, new world, here we come. Brave and trepid, and then some. Pioneers of maximum audacity, whose resumes show that we
into the episode. I just want to address some feedback that we got on our most recent episode, which is Jonah, a VeggieTales movie. I never thought we would get so much feedback on a film.
It was a lot.
But it was very much warranted. We did get some constructive criticism and feedback that perhaps some of the information we gave about Big Idea, which is the studio which produces the VeggieTales films, was not entirely accurate, and it was indeed speculation.
Yeah.
And I completely agree with that. I even prefaced, I don't know what went down, but this is what I think, and proceeded to spout off what I thought, which turned out to not be true at all. And really, there was no place for that because it was completely not true. It was biased. It was just, we tried to present the facts to our listeners as much as possible because that's how you can learn about these films and what's working and what's not working and what happened behind the scenes. And that was very much on me. I apologize for doing that. What I am going to be going in and doing, and by the time this episode is released, this will already have happened, but I'm going to go back and re-edit that episode to remove any of those instances where I'm just making up stuff about Big Idea. And really the reason it happened is because I wasn't as familiar with Big Idea as I had mentioned. This was my first time watching anything VeggieTales. And I just didn't have the time that I normally would have to prepare researching this studio. And instead of saying, I didn't properly research, let's just not talk, I decided to just fill it in and just let my mouth run. And I'm appreciative of the listeners for calling me out on that. So by the time you're listening to this, that will be edited out. However, Chelsea and I are going to go back at some future point in time, maybe the next week or two, next time Chelsea and I get together, and re-record that segment just so that it is accurate. There was a great book that was recommended to us, which is Me, Myself, and Bob, which is a firsthand account of the Big Idea studio and what happened. So I'm going to listen to that. Chelsea's going to listen to that. We're going to come back more informed. So, I mean, for those of you who've already listened to the episode, unless you want to go back and re-listen to that at a future point. But I just wanted to let you guys know that I was aware of that. And I know some people were pretty ticked. Like, I can't believe they did that. That's rude. Like,
they were quite ticked.
And like I said, I completely own it. It was true. And I appreciate you guys for standing up for the studio and standing up for truth.
Fake news.
It was indeed fake news. I'm sorry about that. So anyway, that is that. So for our main discussion, we are going to be talking about DreamWorks Animation's film, The Road to El Dorado. This actually is the third film that DreamWorks Animation had come out. And we're going to talk about, you know, our history with the film and thoughts when it first came out. However, DreamWorks has done 36 films.
That's amazing.
They are coming up and inching up.
In 17 years, like in 20 years, basically.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, and the reason I mention that is because on rotoscopers.com, we do different countdowns from time to time. We've done the Pixar canon, we've done the Disney canon countdown, we've done Studio Ghibli canon countdown, and the new countdown that we're going to be doing is the DreamWorks Animation countdown, where we do an article basically reviewing and talking about each film in the DreamWorks Animation canon. So when I was looking at the list to sign up, I was just very shocked that there are, I said 36, but actually 35 animated films, with Captain Underpants being the most recent. And it's interesting, when you go back to this initial list, you can definitely see how DreamWorks hadn't quite found its own yet.
No.
They had Ants, which was kind of a ripoff of A Bug's Life.
Right.
Now people will argue, what's the ripoff of what? We're not going there today. Prince of Egypt was very much in the style of animated films at the time. You know,
yeah.
Grand epic with this musical number. One of their best, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And The Road to El Dorado, which is the focus of this episode. I mean, to me, initially watching it, I was like, wow, there's a lot of elements that feel borrowed from what was popular at the time.
Yeah. They were really trying to figure out who they were.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeffrey Katzenberg was very much like, this was the third release of theirs, so he's still very much, even though he's the director, the owner, the big kahuna, you know, of the company at this time, he was involved in every little thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually did get to watch the making of, because I actually do have this DVD.
Nice.
The special edition.
Oh.
Which I'm like, was there a non-special edition?
There never is a non-special edition. It's always a special edition.
This is special. Like, I'm special. So I don't even know. But he was, even though he wasn't the director, he is kind of a director, but uncredited as mm-hmm. the director. We have the directors of Bibo Bergeron and Don Paul. Bibo, we've actually done an interview with, and he's
amazing.
He's so great. We love Bibo. And it's just really funny to see, like, Jeffrey, he's still head on the reins and doing all the little, he's the one that's doing some of the main interviews and the face of the company still. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty fun to see, go back in time and see, like, the beginnings of what was going on.
As far as release date for this film, it came out on March 31st, 2000. It had a budget of $95 million, which is pretty respectable.
Mm-hmm.
However, box office, it was considered a box office flop. It did around $50.9 million domestically, and worldwide only made a total of $76.4 million. Ouch.
Yeah,
two-thirds were in the U.S. The other third were international territories. And still $20 million less than its budget.
This is the only DreamWorks Animation picture to not profit at the box office.
Oh, wow. Very interesting.
They were actually wanting to do a series of sequels to this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But because it was such a flop, they're like, nope, scrap that.
Yeah, no one cares about these characters.
Save the sequels for Shrek.
Oh,
when
yes.
that comes out. And they have.
You know what? Recently, the Despicable Me franchise surpassed Shrek as the highest grossing animated franchise of all time. Because you remember, Shrek was just this behemoth.
Yeah.
Not to go off on a Shrek tangent, but I'm going to do it. But it was just huge. And forever, it was like nothing is going to be able to beat Shrek. And recently, Despicable Me franchise has done that. So, sorry, Road to El Dorado. This, I know you wanted to be the greatest animated franchise of all time, but not this time.
Didn't work out.
We'll talk about that.
I thought it was interesting. So just kind of like taking you back to 2000, some of the animated films of the time. So you had The Emperor's New Groove that came out that year, Chicken Run, Dinosaur, which was the top animation film of the year, which is like, oh, geez, Dinosaur. But so Chicken Run, Emperor's New Groove, and then Pokemon the Movie 2000.
Oh, yeah.
I figure I put this in there just so Morgan could say hurry. Oh, yeah. then you had Rugrats in Paris, the movie, The Tigger Movie, Fantasia 2000, and then Road to El Dorado was number 8. But it did beat Titan A.E., so...
Yeah, I mean, it doubled what Titan A.E. did worldwide, and, I mean, we were going, ouch, when for this movie, just not making it by 20 million. Ouch for Titan A.E. Really did not resonate with audiences. And I'm just sitting here, and I'm thinking, wow, this really tells you a lot about animated films in the year 2000 when Dinosaur is your highest grossing film by a decent amount, nearly $350 million worldwide.
Yeah.
That, quite good, quite good.
Right.
And yeah,
well,
about
technically
that.
DreamWorks was involved in Chicken Run, and so they did get some, I guess helped their revenues. For this movie to take care of
but
that.
But you can see there is definitely sort of a half and half thing that's going on here. Some of these films are, well, I mean, one is CGI, another is stop motion, and then we have the 2D films.
Right.
But, I mean, even just 5 years from now, that wasn't going to be the case.
Right.
So there, we're starting to see a shift.
Yeah. So I was looking this up on Wikipedia, and I just love how they try to like categorize different films. So this one, officially Wikipedia calls it, The Road to El Dorado is a 2000 American animated adventure, musical, fantasy, comedy film.
How many adjectives can we put?
I was like, thanks, Wikipedia.
It is all of those things, I guess.
Right.
But fantasy, I don't know. I guess there are slight fantastical elements there, but yeah it's all of those things and more.
The legend of a lost city of gold and the two men brave enough to find it.
I am Miguel,
and I am Tulio.
And they call us Miguel and Tulio.
Seven! Your dice are loaded!
I will give you the honor of a quick and painless death. But not with that.
I'll bet we can make that.
Two pesetas says we can't.
You're all... You lose.
DreamWorks Pictures invites you...
Holy shit!
Oh, no!
To join two friends on an incredible journey.
We'll follow that trail.
What trail?
To the magnificent city of gold.
El Dorado.
Big smile, like you mean it.
They actually think we're gods.
Miguel and Tulio.
The mighty and powerful gods.
Hello.
Now.
You're going to need my help.
What makes you think we need your help?
Are you serious?
They're bound for excitement.
Yeah! Who's the guy?
You the guy.
Go!
Romance.
Huh?
And danger.
I know you are not gods.
You're not a god?
That was good, huh?
Featuring 6 new songs from Elton John and Tim Rice, the Oscar-winning team from The Lion King. The Road to El Dorado.
Stop that!
I think we're going to do more of a instead of going plot by plot point, mm-hmm. we're going to do more of a high, just our favorite moments of the film. So the plot summary is basically, while pulling off a scam, you've got two con artists who get their hands on a map to the fabled city of gold, El Dorado. Their plan goes wrong, and somehow the two end up lost at sea. And then serendipitously, they end up on the shores of El Dorado.
I'd say the majority of this film is serendipitously.
Right.
I mean, the fact that even how they end up on the boat...
Right.
It's very serendipitous.
With the horse.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
It's like, wow. Okay. And then they are then worshipped by the natives as gods because they happen to come up and look like a statue that somebody carved out, mm-hmm. you know, 100 years prior. Who knows? But yeah, so that's basically the plot summary. And humor ensues.
Oh, yes. Miguel and Tulio.
Tulio Miguel.
I liked that. You know what? I really did like their relationship.
Because I did,
you could tell that they were friends. And, you know, Tulio or Miguel says Tulio and Miguel. Like, he puts Tulio first.
Right.
But Miguel flips it and says Miguel and Tulio or whatever. And so I just kind of like that little moment because I'm like, oh, BFFs. So
yeah.
cute.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, they were in production with Prince of Egypt when this was mm-hmm. starting. And so they're like, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg was like, you know what? And I'm obviously putting in my own thing right
Chelsea
now.
Chelsea Flair.
So Katzenberg says, you know what? Let's do something that kind of departs from the serious adult approach. And let's just do a buddy film, you know, a comedy adventure. Like, okay. And so that's kind of where this whole thing goes. And he actually said, he's like, you know, we've never seen it where the sidekicks get their own film. I'm like thinking now in 2017, I feel like every sidekick has its own film.
It's true. Minions, Shaun the Sheep.
Right.
We could go on and on and on. Tigger movie. I mean, come
yeah.
on. You know, and okay, would you consider... Okay, let's just talk about Tulio and Miguel initially, because we're mentioning these characters. But would you consider them to be sidekicks? Like, they are, I guess... I mean, who would they have been sidekicks to?
That is,
I feel
yeah.
like they're just a duo, not necessarily mm-hmm. like sidekick to any main guy.
Yeah.
Which obviously, because we don't see them being the number two and three to someone else, but...
And I thought about this. I was thinking, okay, what makes them sidekick versus like main protagonist? Like the single person, mm-hmm. you know, like the genie to the Aladdin, you know, or no, let's not say the genie because the genie does not go with this example. Let's say the minions to Gru. I feel like they don't really show the I Want song, you know? There is
that would be amazing. A Minions I Want song.
It would be amazing. No, but I feel like you don't really get to know them as like you're not really ever rooting for them. They're just kind of
they're enabling the protagonist to get what they want.
Right. And I just for this movie, because like Genie, you are rooting for him. Mm-hmm. Like he has to be free, not to yeah. be my own master. You know, these guys, it's like, ooh, Cuba.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like there's no like main drive for them other than get along, like just move, mm-hmm. adventure. You know, let's just go. And so I think that's one of the main things that keeps it from grabbing the heart of the audience. I feel like this is a fun movie. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of fun things, fun elements, but it's kind of forgettable.
Yeah, they're very flawed, you know, which you need flawed characters, mm-hmm. but particularly they are con men. They're scam artists. We see that the very first scene where they're, you know, doing this con in the streets with their weighted dice and they're always rolling sevens. And luckily they're able to get out of it. And then they con themselves out of that again with their shtick where they're pretending to fight with each other.
Right.
And then
it's a great shtick.
They're able to escape. It's great. But we see very quickly that, okay, these are con men. And, you know, then over the course of the film, we're supposed to see their progression and how they change and root for them. But to me, that doesn't come till the very, very almost like last 5 to 10 minutes. Because for the whole film, all they want to do is get the gold. And I guess in Tulio's case, get the girl. But even Shell, she's not a very altruistic character
no.
either. Because her very first scene with her is she's... I guess, pulling a con or trying to steal something.
Right.
And then they all hook up together. So it's like, oh, bad meets bad meets bad. Let's go. Mm-hmm. You know, so, but let's just talk about the characters initially. So out of the two, who do you prefer? Do you, so Miguel is the blonde with the, you know, mm-hmm. the little bob, I guess, bob haircut.
The lob.
Yes. And Tulio has the dark hair, the goatee, so
he's
on and so
forth. He's the pessimist, you know, mm-hmm. and Miguel's the dreamer.
Yeah.
You know what?
I like Miguel so much more.
Yeah, I like Miguel too. I feel like he's, because he is the altruistic, he is the more altruistic, mm-hmm. and the fact that he's like, no, no more sacrifices. Mm-hmm. Like he's actually putting on a little bit of a leadership role when Tulio never really puts on a leadership role. Tulio is always in the background. Miguel yeah. is the one, he's kind of trying to make change and trying to just stand up for what is right. Even though they are con men, he still yeah. has that moral integrity. People shouldn't be sacrificed.
Well, they both have that, don't they?
They do, but
because like, they both are like, ooh, no. They when right. that sacrifice is first introduced, but he really has the moral fortitude to go and yeah. stop it, I right. guess.
Yeah, so I think Miguel is probably, if you're looking at the two, he's going to be the one with the most moral fiber.
Yeah.
But the two of them, it's interesting. As I was watching the making of, they kept talking about how it was amazing to have them both in studio together. And I'm just like, and I understand for animated movies, you don't have to. A great actor doesn't have to have the other person in the room to be able to pull off a great line, but it does make it easier in a bit.
Well, they always make it seem like it's this amazing thing. Like, wow, they recorded this in the same room.
I know.
And I'm thinking, like, for any actor, this is your job, okay? For any live-action film, you would have to be on set right. the days that you're required to be on set.
Right.
And for some reason, I guess in animation, because we do the voices beforehand and then they go and they animate to it, I guess there's more leniency in scheduling where it's like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, we can get away with just scheduling you based on whenever you're free. But I right. think if this was something that was really important to them, they would just tell the actors straight up, you need to be available on these days. You're right. going to be recording with this other person or this cast, and boom, it's done. But I don't know if it's interesting. I'm not in the industry, so I don't know. But why?
I mean, I can understand it for scheduling and money purposes. Like they, mm-hmm. like you, it can take longer.
Yeah.
The more elements that you put in, it adds more a series of more possible errors, you know?
Yeah.
And they did talk about how it was actually a technical issue because they were just going off and doing so much. And so you can't really get a clean sound yeah. a lot of times because they keep moving around or whatever. Like they are talking to each other and trying to like play around. But I mean, it is really cool because the two of them, like Kevin Kline and Kenneth Branagh, they are the main guys and they do really work well together.
Yeah, they do have great chemistry.
Yeah. And they ended up later on, and so they probably recorded this in 98 or so, 97, 98.
Mid-90s, yeah.
In 1999, they were actually together in the movie Wild Wild West, so.
That was their pitch. Hey, we've done this before. I know.
Hey, you like that movie? Nobody saw it, but don't worry about that.
It's coming, so let's just get
exactly.
on.
Exactly. Well, no, yeah, because this didn't come out till 2000, so.
I'm always interested in things like that because animated films, there's so much pre-production, and typically the voices are done years in advance. And just how it ends up being that they're able to find people who, by the time the film comes out, that maybe they were a lesser known entity. By the time the film comes out, it's like, boom,
yeah,
you're a big deal.
Yeah.
Now, it's, I mean, maybe
serendipitously.
Obviously, they know a lot more behind the scenes about what projects these people are involved in, where they right. can be like, okay, this person's going to be big, or they're, you know, they see the trajectory.
Right.
But it's just so interesting so many times where they totally get it right.
Yeah. It's like whoever their manager is like, on mm-hmm. on ball. I like that. As far as the animation goes for this one, most of it is 2D elements, but they did use a lot of the what they called Dan Phillips. He was the digital supervisor, and he's like, I think that the work of El Dorado is the embodiment of tradigital convergence. And I'm like,
oh,
holy crap, what
the
is
old
that?
Tradigital.
Tradigital.
Yeah, you know,
the best mixture of traditional and digital animation techniques.
I saw some of that tradigital work, and it was the very end of, you know, where you have the water splaying yeah. out, and I thought, that doesn't seem to fit But we're going with it. The movie's almost over.
It's 2000. Go for it. Whatever.
Well, this was very common at the time. Yeah. We see this with Anastasia, Titan A.E. It was like, wow, how can we incorporate these CGI elements? They're so cool. At the opening scenes, you see a lot of it because just the different panning camera movements during the opening credits. You know, they go down this waterfall and they have this liquid gold going along with it. And if you're looking, it's very clear that, oh, this was done on a computer.
Right. Nice. Well, and they're like, this is the first time we're able to really make gold look like gold. I'm like, actually kind of, I don't really like it, honestly. Like, I feel like...
You don't like gold or you don't like the tradigital?
I don't like the tradigital gold.
Ah, tradigital gold.
Mm-hmm. I just feel
like... Is that like a Bitcoin?
Yeah, maybe. Tradigital gold. I feel like it's just... It's almost distracting because it's so off kilter of what the 2D elements are. But that's just me.
So talking about how the film looks aesthetically, I think for the most part, it's very well done. I was looking at the animation even from the very beginning, and I was just very impressed with how far animation had come over the past decades. You know, by late 90s, even... all the studios had their act together for the most part. If you were putting out a feature and you were DreamWorks, Disney, whatnot, your animation looked great. And this one did. The character designs, they, you know, it's funny. Walt Disney Animation and DreamWorks Animation had a very similar style because the Disney style had become popular. DreamWorks spun off and it made sense to kind of copy elements of that. Other studios did it as well. But at the same time, DreamWorks has a very unique version of it. Like, I feel like their characters are a little bit more angular in the way that they're designed. Yeah. And it's the DreamWorks Disney.
I mean, because you think about it, at the time, so many people left Disney for DreamWorks. I mean, he just went over there and poached them all. So I'm like, it is what it is.
That's a free market.
Yeah, free market for you. So you've got so many people who, quote, grew up with the same styles.
Yeah.
And so they're all used to doing that. But then they're like, okay, let's shift it just a little bit to make it our own thing.
Which is what they do for each movie anyway.
Yeah. And I remember when we went to D23... a couple of years ago, we were talking to a guy who worked at one of the studios, and he was just like, yeah, they're kind of all the same. Because when one film isn't in animation mode, what do the animators do? Well, they go and work for another studio whose film is in animation mode. And so they just kind of like circle around. So you all have the same people working at all of the different companies. And so I love how today... the technology isn't necessarily what sells a movie anymore. It is, because I feel like you look at like How to Train Your Dragon, and they're trying to throw in a lot more of the really realistic animation keys and like make it look really, I mean, just crisp and clean. But I also feel like it's almost become a non thing in the way that everyone is really kind of the same. And so you just have to deal with making sure that you have a great story, great characters. And when Jeffrey Katzenberg envisioned the film, he actually envisioned kind of like a Bob Hope, Bing Crosby style buddy comedy. And so you can actually really see that like in the music editing and the just like the timing of the jokes and you know, he's got his little guitar. Ring.
I love that little guitar.
I loved it too. And so you do have a lot of those elements. Like, they're trying to really create good characters. They're trying to really create a feel for individuality in a world where it's kind of hard to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting because high level, you would think this has all the elements of something that would make a great animated film. You have, you know, a fantastic animation team, great look and feel. You know, this isn't so out there. It's where it's off-putting to audiences. I mean, this animation and these character designs more or less were what audiences were used to at this point in time. It does have music, which we will talk about, but for some reason it just fell flat, and I think that's really what we're going to go into the next little bit. But before we do, can I just give a little Jim Cummings shout out?
Yay, Jim Cummings!
He was one of the first people that we heard, and I melt inside when I hear Jim Cummings' voice, and I love when he gets to be more of a star role. Now, I think there were six, maybe seven speaking characters. I think it's six, and then the horse, I guess, is a seventh like speaking character, but doesn't really speak English. Right. But I love that one of those was Jim Cummings.
I know. We heart Jim. He's someone that I would like to.
And speaking of the
interview.
Horse, we have Altivo the horse, who the creators called the Fabio of horses.
I think he was. I consider Altivo was pretty Fabio-like with his hair flowing.
And fabulous. The
fabulous hair.
No, one day we're going to have the animation horse discussion. He needs to be on the list.
We already had one where it was like Disney horses, but I feel like we need to do like all animation horses. If you have a horse that you would like to contribute to this list, make sure to put that on rotoscopers.com/153.
And then other characters, we have that little armadillo that once they do land on
He was interesting.
He just follows them around. And really the key plot point with him is being the ball.
The ball,
to help for yet another scam.
Right, right. The funny thing is they actually, like, all he did was squeak once or twice, mm-hmm. And they never gave him a name. But to the animators and to, like, production crew, they actually called him Bebo after the director. I was like, oh, that's nice.
Little Bebo. So cute.
I was really impressed with the rowboat that was able to, like, carry the horse and the two.
Like I said,
they don't build them like they used to, apparently.
With most movies, you need to suspend your belief, right?
Right.
And I think going back, I kind of feel bad about my review of My Neighbor Totoro. And I do feel that I need to go back and rewatch that movie a month or two from now that I kind of know what to expect, and then give my thoughts again.
You are falling to criticism here.
No, I know. I just wasn't in the right state of mind when I watched that movie, I believe. But this one, it's like, okay, here, let's go on this magic carpet ride of all sorts of crazy things to get here. So first, they do this con, then they somehow end up in these barrels that at the exact moment they need to get put on the boat, and then they don't get opened until after they leave. Then Cortez kicks them out because he has very meticulously planned every member of his crew. And so they lose.
More than the disciples of Christ.
Yes. Like, and so they escape on a boat. And then this boat is able to overcome the most crazy storm ever with a horse in it, mind you. They land on land. And, not to mention, we also have the map to El Dorado that some dude that we were playing in our dice match happened to have. That is my question. How did that guy get the map? Because... Yeah. I mean, we know...
Wasn't Cortez going for that in the beginning?
Yes, exactly. And we know that people had visited the Americas prior to, when Cortez was supposed to go. So someone had to go, retrieve the map, and through a series of events, this map ends in that guy's hands, who ends up in their hands. Oh, and by the way, out of all the coastline where we land, we land at the starting point of the map. Enter song montage, where we go through each of the
on
points.
The trail,
check, and boom. We reach the end. And that's just the first 30 minutes, my friends. This is animation. This is stories. I mean, come on. I'm being a little hard, but they very fortuitous.
Very. Okay, I want to ask you about the Trailer Blaze. I actually liked the song itself. What were your thoughts?
So I could not really tell you much about the song because I've already forgotten it.
Aww.
As with most of the songs in this, I feel that they did have a great crew, and they had Hans Zimmer, they had Elton John, they had Tim Rice. However, they just didn't stick. I felt that they fell flat, and they did not touch my soul in a way that I guess other films would. And I know they wanted initially to make this a musical, but then decided, let's be different and let's not have the characters sing the songs. There's only one song where they sing it. And
it's time to be a guy.
Yeah, exactly. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that song. But I don't know. And I'm trying to think of... There weren't other musical animated films prior to this point that kind of had this format.
Yeah.
Tarzan came out in 99, so I guess. But these were in development around the same time. So I can't say one copied the other. But for me, it works in Tarzan. And here, it just does not work. And the songs just don't... There's no cohesive vein to the songs, I feel, that hold them together and make me want to listen to them.
Yeah. So basically, they early on decided that they wanted to do a world music theme. They go up to Elton John and Tim Rice and say, hey, we want to do 6 or 7 songs for this movie, and we wanted a world theme. You guys did great with The Lion King. We want to do it again. And that was like in the making of, they really pushed that. It's like the award winning team from The Lion King. Jeffrey Katzenberg comes in. He's like, yeah, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity to get all of you guys together, and we get to do it twice. This is just amazing. You know, adding Hans Zimmer into the mix as well. Interestingly enough, John Powell and Klaus Badelt both did an additional music for this, and I think that's just cool to kind of see where other composers kind of get their start or cut their teeth, you know, mm-hmm. like the additional scenes. So I thought that was cool. But the main team, Elton John, Tim Rice, Hans Zimmer, they really were trying to push the Lion King vibe. Mm-hmm. And I understand why, obviously. You want it to be great. But I kind of agree with you in the fact that in and of themselves, I like the music. I like some of the music.
In the moment, they're fine. Yeah. After the fact, it's like, I can't tell you anything about that song. Yeah. It's just passed from my memory.
Yeah. And that's, and I kind of feel like that's like the whole project, though. Mm-hmm. Like the movie itself, I remember watching it. I feel like it's a good movie. It's a good time. It's nothing to be ashamed of in any way. Like it's
just
good.
Missing that little element of magic that just takes it to the next level.
It does, yeah. And I do recognize when I hear it, the On the Trail replays.
Yeah.
And then that's really the only song that really sticks with me. There's another song, the two singles that they put out from El Dorado was Someday Out of the Blue, which is like the theme. And I give that a meh. I really am not a fan of that song. But Friends Never Say Goodbye, I actually do like that song. Mm-hmm. And I would listen to it on its own. But it's not one. And I would recognize, oh, yeah, that is from El Dorado. But it's hard for me to go back and sing it to you right now.
Yeah.
The better ones that kind of stick with you more are On the Trail Blaze, because it's got a good hook right there. And then, you know, you remember It's Tough to Be a God just because of how corny it is.
Yeah, that kind of reminded me of a mix of Under the Sea and A Friend Like Me, where uh-huh. they kind of go into these psychedelic elements of color. And I'm in a different plateau, you know, like this background disappears and it's just like a plain background, and yeah. they're like dancing on a wine glass. And maybe that's to depict that they are getting drunk, because they are.
Right.
And in the morning, it's this massive hangover that they have to recover from. But it was very much a Pink Elephants on Parade esque moment where yeah. it's the psychedelic colors and we're dancing and it's fun. And then we have to recover after the crash.
Yeah. Well, that one was funny. It had its own little moments in there on the making of. And I'm sure the guys totally appreciated this. But when they were singing this song together, Jeffrey Katzenberg said, I'm pretty sure that the singing session will go down as the most embarrassing moments of their respective careers. And I'm like, and then he kind of like tries to turn it. Like, I mean, they're pretty good singers. But I mean, you know, anybody singing, even a pretty good singer singing Elton John song, trail off, don't actually finish the like thought process.
Crickets.
Just like, why would you put that in there? Like, they're trying to make it like, oh, it was fun and just like, ha ha ha.
Now I want to see that recording session. Like, give me that as a bonus feature. Thank you very much.
And they do like show snippets of, hey, oh man. And then you got like a cut from Jeffrey, like, you know, we do have that on tape. We have recorded that whole thing. And these guys look like they are just like, oh geez,
quit bringing it up, Jeffrey. We got it. Paid us to do this, okay?
Right. And then they're coming, like, they interviewed them afterwards, like, oh my gosh, we did that so many times. And in my head, I'm just thinking, quit complaining, you nincompoops. like, this is what you're getting paid for. Like, you gotta do it right. But anyway, like, I guess I've when you're used to doing something so many times until you get it right, it's like, why are you complaining about this? Mm-hmm. Just because you're acting, you get to do your own spin. And now you have Hans Zimmer, who's like, you know, they called him like cracking the whip, you know, like a slave driver in a way. And I'm like, well, it's probably because you weren't good.
That's what good coaches do.
Right.
They don't let your mediocrity pass.
Exactly. Exactly. So anyway, I would love to work with Hans. Oh, he's so cool.
So the songs, pretty good, but not that great.
Yeah.
Sort of meh all around. Very forgettable.
Yeah. Well, and Yeah, I wish I could say that I liked them better than I did, but I feel like they're passable.
Yeah.
All of them. And then they came back, you know, when Elton John and Tim Rice came back, they're like, oh, wow, we came back with 10 songs, you know, like for the album. And even Backstreet Boys did a rendition of one of their songs for the album itself.
Mm-hmm.
But because of their label issues, like they weren't able to put them as credited being the singers of the song.
Yeah.
So it was just interesting how it's like didn't quite work out the way they wanted it to.
As with most things with this film.
Yeah, well.
So I want to talk about the story of this film and kind of the premise. Obviously, the film is based on the legend of the City of Gold, El Dorado, which has been a legend from all different places over the years. Initially, it started as kind of this idea of a person. It turned into like a myth and then a legend and then a city and then this empire, right?
Right.
So over the years, it's changed in what it was. I think reading back that the initial idea of El Dorado came from Colombia, where this new chief or this new leader doused himself in powdered gold as like part of the ritual, and that's the beginning, right?
Wow.
And then it formed into this, okay, there's this city of gold where it's hidden.
Why not?
Yeah, and I think this is very indicative of this time in animation, because I feel that by this point, a lot of the main fairy tales had been done, especially by Disney in the decades prior, but then Disney had gone off and they'd made themselves a name by, let's take fairy tales or stories later that are very, you know, popular or well known, and we'll put our Disney spin on it. So we start with, you know, some fairy tales, you know, I'm talking like the Renaissance. We have Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin. These are all stories from different cultures and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Mulan, Hunchback of Notre Dame. And then it's like, okay, not that the well is running dry, because there's always so many stories to be told. But then we kind of go into this era where there's kind of a few films that copy each other.
Yeah.
So Road to El Dorado, I mean, we have Atlantis, The Lost Empire,
right,
which comes out later. And I'm just thinking that these are so similar. And then we also have Pocahontas. So these are the three films where it's people from the Western world go to a civilization that is lost or unknown or undiscovered. Right.
Right.
And
Manifest Destiny keeps going.
And with this, it's just the very beginning of it. It doesn't feel very unique to me. Not until we get to the actual city where they are seen as gods by the native people is where I'm like, okay, this is different. You know, obviously Pocahontas, they were not seen as gods. They were seen as threats,
right,
and needed to be destroyed. Atlantis, they weren't seen as gods, but they were kind of
hand in hand. They were unknown.
Worked together. Yeah. But it wasn't putting you on a pedestal, but it wasn't you're the enemy, at least not initially. So yeah, this is the one different element. So the world that we live in today, films that were maybe made 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago probably wouldn't be made in the same way nowadays.
Right.
I think of Aladdin, there's a lot of backlash with Aladdin because of how it has taken on different aspects of that culture. And with this film, there are stereotypes or misconceptions about Latin American culture. And with this film in particular, it's not set in a particular country.
Right. Yeah, well, like, in order to avoid connecting El Dorado to, like, any of the particular geographical places, the aesthetics, like, just the different places, they added different parts of Aztec, different parts of Mayan. They just added different pre-Hispanic cultures of of Central America so that you can't, like, pinpoint, oh, it's Mexico.
Yeah.
So, Guatemala.
Yeah, and, you know, they did go and do research trips, and even this was very common for these films, especially way late into the 90s, to go and do research trips. But it just seems like even now that there's so much criticism against it, it's like, I feel like there's no amount of research that you can do that would ever, like, appease a certain subset of the audience. There's always going to be a particular subset of people that are, like, so offended by what you did.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Whenever I'm one group and I'm making a film or a work of art about another group, it's going to be my interpretation of that. Whether that is true or false or spun, or you're going to have a wide range in between. And I don't think they were trying to make this 100% accurate to history, because this is not a historical film.
Right. If your main characters
Cortez is the only element that existed in the real world.
Right. Well, they're trying to give a reason as to why Cortez did not find the city of El Dorado, mm-hmm. because you had Miguel and Julio who messed it all up, and they ended up closing off the river and the gate. So now that this entire culture is still lost, and it's honestly, can I just say, I think that it is the same one and the same with Atlantis. I think they are the same.
The same city, huh?
The same city, yes, I do. Because I think that what happened... think about it. You got the glowing ice into the mystical arts.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as a few generations go by without having any contact to the outside world, their food evolves, and therefore, like flamingos, so do they. And their skin turns that pale silver color with the white hair. I mean, there's something obviously missing from their diet.
Loss of pigmentation. Check.
Check. And they obviously don't know how to interpret their own writings even at this point. And so the exception of the aristocratic, it just went down from there. Like, there were a subset of people within this that obviously had more knowledge, and they created all of these flying fish, mm-hmm. like, you know, jet skis. But
they had about 300 years to make that happen.
I think
from
so.
From like 1600s to when Milo comes in early 20th century.
Yeah. And by that time, right. Man, I think that that's what happened.
You heard it here first. Disney, or I guess this isn't a Disney theory, but
Disney,
it's a
Disney DreamWorks crossover theory.
Whoa.
But I mean, going back to what you were saying, when you are envisioning two characters that are going after Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, do you really expect this to be historically accurate? I mean,
exactly. Just like how I had issue with certain films in the past where I'm like, I can't believe this is possible. Like, it's just so unrealistic. This is the same thing.
I love your comic book guy.
We're from two different worlds. Worst episode ever.
Seriously.
But I agree. I feel like there's always going to be a group of people who are going to be upset. And one criticism I've heard, and I'm interested to talk about this character, because when I first saw this movie, there are certain scenes with this character that were really off-putting for me, and it's Shell.
Shell, yeah.
Yes. She is this very sexy, voluminous mm-hmm. character. Apparently, she was supposed to be even more over the top mm-hmm. and sexy and scantily clad. Like, mm-hmm. they just wanted to go all out with her as making her, like, super seductress.
Right.
They toned her back. Even then, I'm still like, whoa. I mean, she does have all the stereotypes of the big lips, the dark hair, the big hips, like everything going on, banging, right?
She's got it going on, girl.
And there are definitely issues with her character in being that she is just seen as, she's, for one, the only female character in the film.
Right.
Who speaks, and she,
I do like her voice actress though.
She did a great job. Yes, every time she was speaking, I'm just like, yes, I love you. Here's the thing, even though people have issue with her, I liked her as a character because I accepted her for what she was and I moved on. I wasn't gonna let this ruin my life, the fact that she wasn't this representation of female feminism. But you know, she's not, and people do say, like, this is a problem where with ethnic characters as well and female characters, that they're kind of shown as kind of like the negative aspect. So she's seen as a thief. She's very, you know, almost a seductress, where she's the one who takes the lead initiating with Tulio, which right. I would say, hey, that usually doesn't happen in films. That's a win that we have a woman who's at least going to take the initiative. But like, you can never win as a woman. Here's the thing I've learned as a woman. You can never win. If you do one thing, here's the thing, you're having kids. If you don't have any kids, you get, well, why aren't you having any kids? Don't you want to have kids? But then once you start having some kids and you have a handful, they say, well, why are you having so many kids? Like, when are you going to stop? It's like, okay, I cannot win. What do you want?
Yeah.
But with her, she likewise, like the men, is not a good character as far as morally.
No.
She very much has a not so altruistic idea. She's going for the
gold.
I'm
not asking you to trust me. Yes. Am I?
Like, this is business, boys. Which, that's fine. Gosh. That is fine that we have these main characters that are, you know, semi-corrupt in their own ways, and that they have a goal that isn't for the betterment of society. And that's fine, because we see these characters grow. I don't know if we necessarily see Shell grow too much. I mean, she learns to love Tulio, and they become a thing and an item. And then... Then they're done.
That's it.
They don't have their gold at the end, but then they have each other. And I don't know. One thing that really did bother me, I saw this movie when I was 14, and the scene with her and Tulio where they're doing something, it implies that they're doing more than kissing. really made me uncomfortable as a 14-year-old because I was seeing with my parents and I was like, ugh, did they have sex? Did they do something else? Or are they just kissing? Hair's all messed up. I don't know. It really...
it applies.
Whoa, DreamWorks went there.
They did. Well, DreamWorks tends to go there.
Yes. And I'm not saying that film should be for kids. So I'm glad they had a scene like that. Now it didn't bother me so much because I accepted it for what it was and I was ready for it. But so I'm just kind of wondering about
not
people...
not necessarily that I'm glad they had a scene like that.
I'm glad they had a sex scene in an animated film that was rated PG.
No, it's just like... We're
more mature. We're not 14.
We're not 14, but it's like...
I just worry about the families that would have taken... And this is any film that maybe wants to push the envelope a little more, is that people just see animation as something for kids, and so they just take their kids to it, not knowing what's... what it entails.
And it's like, definitely like being marketed as the fun, mm-hmm. you know... just
springtime film.
Right.
For springtime family film. Doesn't even say at that very beginning it was a... Did not say family film.
No.
Okay, never mind.
All right.
Perfect. So there we go. So I'm actually interested to hear what you guys think about Chell and how she's portrayed and just different aspects of the film. So definitely when we go to the show notes, rotoscopers.com/153, let's have a discussion down in there.
Do it.
So other characters that we haven't talked about, just high level, we have the two leaders.
The chief and the priest. The priest.
And they are diametrically opposed mm-hmm. because one has this one philosophy and the other is waiting for the coming of the Jaguar.
Right.
And you can see that by these two coming, it was sort of the prophecy. And we see it on the tablet where it's two guys on some sort of snake and ends up being the horse, right? You know, ride in. And so initially I'm thinking, okay, do they buy that these guys are gods or are they just kind of going with it to see if they can get their own way? And initially they do both believe that they are gods.
Yeah, they do. Well, you know that the priest is actually hoping that the gods will come down and give their power to him.
Yes.
And so that's what he's been waiting for.
My favorite is our very first scene with him. It's just bad guy, bad guy, bad guy. It wasn't the big nose syndrome.
No.
It was just he's in the dark room, very ominous, mm-hmm. and it's very obvious what his intentions are and that he is going to be our bad guy. This is not 2013 where it was like, guy is hidden and we're going to do the bait and switch. It's
right.
going to be the Hans.
Right.
Chell is going to be the bad guy.
Ooh.
So, no, they made it very obvious that we knew who to root for, who not to root for. And I guess maybe
that.
I guess we kind of needed that because out of these two, I guess maybe I would have liked to have had out of these two, I need to figure out for myself who to trust, which is what Miguel and them had to do. But we as an audience, we're privy to this guy is bad. He's kind of doing things in the shadows. And the chief, as far as we know, is all around good guy, especially in the way that he like, hey, let's have a feast. And the other guy's like, no, let's have a sacrifice.
Yeah.
And they start painting like this guy starts doing good things and this guy's doing bad things.
Right.
It would have been interesting to have us figure that out on our own because it's just more like giving it to you on a platter. Like we are the gods and DreamWorks says, here, we're going to give you every plot point. It's going to be very obvious. Eat.
Swallow what we give you.
One of the other scenes that stands out to me in this film is the ball scene where they are playing ball, their version of this sport where you have to kind of kick it into a hoop or with your hip, you can't really touch it, and how, well, I wanted to make it a fair battle for you, so these are the best players in all the land, and just against you two, I think that should work out, and they're like, ugh! And
dope.
Because initially they wanted to take their money and run,
right.
And they extended out to 3 days or a few days, and yeah, so they have to figure their way out of this. And then this is the reason why we had the armadillo all along, is because we needed some way to have them yet again
pull
another con. It's again, this whole time it's like con, scam. How can we trick these people? And so even though we're trying, at the same time they're showing us different elements of their personality to make us like them, it's still like, but you're still doing all these horrible things and taking advantage of these people.
Yeah. They got to push out the narrative somehow, you know, and Miguel, that's the interesting thing. Like, okay, if Miguel's going to be sticking around, how is he going to keep this whole God thing up? Like, is he just going to always be the God of this culture? And now he's the chief guy. I don't know. And like,
well, the chief calls him out on it eventually when he's on the boat and he's taking his thing away. And then Miguel's trying to come up with ways to get rid to postpone. And eventually says, you know, if you just want to stay, you're almighty God. You just have to say it. And he's like, oh, great, perfect. And he's like, oh, no worries. To err is human.
Right.
Him subtly saying,
I know you.
I know.
Yeah.
You're not, you know, but I'm surprised they don't, at that moment, doesn't say, okay, I figured you out. You're not a god. I'm going to put you in jail.
Right. I'm okay. not going to let you take my stuff.
Yes. Well, the whole idea with the El Dorado is that they were so benevolent and just isolated that gold didn't have the intrinsic value that it did to everywhere else right. in the world. It was just stuff. It was just right. something.
It was shiny.
And
pretty.
It just, yeah, it was great material to build our buildings with.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they're throwing it as the initial sacrifice to the whirlpool down below, it doesn't mean anything to them
yeah.
because it doesn't have this value that's like something that needs to be obtained at all costs.
Right.
Which is interesting why at the very beginning, if supposedly this city is so isolated, no one else can get to it, unless you have like a secret map that shows you the way, why at the beginning is Chell stealing and trying to leave? Like, she's stealing gold, but why would she know that gold is even worth anything elsewhere?
Yeah, those are little things
again,
that you're like,
maybe she's been out. She's
she
been
probably
elsewhere.
Has.
And she,
I mean, she knows how to
again,
get out.
And she's like, I need as much of this as possible. And that's what she does, is she wants a cut of the share. So she obviously has a better understanding than the other people. And for the most part, the people in this film, we don't know anything about the people other than they're almost sheep-like, where they're just
yeah.
like, yes, cool.
As you ordered.
Yes, as you ordered, bow down. Which, again, is another criticism of the film, is that, you know, the native people are seen as the lesser people. Like, they don't have the intelligence to figure this out on their own. But without that, we wouldn't have a story.
Right.
You know, and we can't tell the story of all 3,000 people in the city. But I think we do see that with the two different leaders of the city that kind of are supposed to represent, you know, one is the more malicious one who is all for himself, which is just like Miguel and Tulio. And the other one really, I think, is more supposed to represent the people. They are good, true, you know, good-hearted people who just want to be happy.
Yeah. Critical response for this. It was nominated for several Annie Awards, mostly for animation-wise and production design, storyboarding and whatnot. Also for voice acting, so yeah. But it did win the Critics' Choice Award for Best Composer. But I don't know if I really trust Critics' Choice Awards, because I feel like they're like the jump on the bandwagon. We liked you before, we're going to keep liking you.
Well, according to the critics, this is a 48%, you know, positive versus negative on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay.
So it's definitely not fresh.
No.
And the critical consensus is predictable story and thin characters make the movie flat. And that's a very great consensus,
yeah.
to be honest.
Yeah.
In this situation, I trust the critics because, like I said, this film, in theory, had all the elements for a great film. It had a myth or a legend source
mm-hmm.
material or fairy tale, you
yeah.
know, in that sort of genre, like pre-existing story that's fun and we can put our own spin on it. Then great animation studio, great team. You know, we have the writing team, we have the directing team, we have Jeffrey Katzenberg as the executive producer. All of these things. And yet it's just not something that did well. It was not something that I had not actually seen this until, maybe I've seen it one other time from the initial time seeing it in theaters. But this, to me, is very indicative of this age in animation. Around 2000 is when animation really started to take a tumble to
yeah.
me, because it was so high in the 90s. We had ridden this wave that just was so exciting. Everything that was coming out was great and grand, and it was almost like Midas's touch, speaking of gold, that
right.
anything Disney particularly touched, and Pixar and a few other studios, it did turn to gold. Even DreamWorks and Don Bluth with Anastasia and
yeah.
Prince of Egypt. I feel those, while not necessarily all the same, did the same level in the box office, they
right.
still are great to me, and I enjoy
and
watching them.
They've definitely stood the test of time.
Yes. But then the films coming out around here, I mean, we're looking at the other films that were released, Dinosaur, Titan A.E.
It's sad that, like, we just say it.
I don't know.
We just laugh.
Apparently people like it. I don't have much for it. You can check out our episode review on it.
Here it is.
Well... Yep. But to me, this is just okay. They had tried things too much, where I don't know if this format had just become stale or it wasn't executed correctly. And I believe it's the latter, because these characters fell flat, the story fell flat, the music fell flat. And as a result, the movie was just kind of a bust. I remember when seeing it, I was like, okay.
I didn't see it in theaters. I only had the DVD. And the only reason my mom, you know, at the time was girls like DVDs. Chelsea Marissa like DVDs. They like these animated films. So just get all the one, get everything. That is true.
Chelsea does have quite the assortment. We have a selection.
We have a selection for sure. And mostly it's a continual selection because Marissa keeps it going. So I appreciate that because it also comes generally with bonus features. So, everyone benefits.
So give me your review of this film.
All around, I think it is not a bad film. There's a lot of good elements, as we were talking about before, but still not super exciting. And it's not one that I remember. Like Marissa, I watched it yesterday, and then Marissa, the DVD was still out and in the player, and so she watched it again. And so I heard it twice. And I just felt like, you know, there's so many good things about it. Like the voice acting I felt was great. I felt like the camaraderie and just the flow of the movie felt good. And it's a fun time while you're watching, but also forgettable after.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I feel like that's just kind of where it is. Elton John music, I mean, I felt like there are highs and lows. I felt like it was good enough, and it worked for the film itself. But once again, on all levels, I just feel like it didn't capture your heart. And that's what makes it kind of a underwatched film even today. Like it's one that people aren't going to be like, oh my gosh, El Road to El Dorado. I mean, there's some people that do. But it's fewer.
So what would you rate it?
I'm going to go with 3 stars. Two and a half would be average. You know, it's like neither good. It's like a neutral film. I liked it enough, but it's forgettable, so you can't go above 3.
Yeah. Yeah, I likewise am going to give it 3 stars. It like I said, it had the elements where in theory it should have been good, but it just fell flat and it did not work for me. In the moment, like Chelsea said, it's fun and I didn't hate myself in my time. How you know. That's my skill. Did I hate myself watching this? That is level one. No, but I thought it was good and I'm like, oh yeah, I remember this. This is cool. But yeah, now that it's over with and I'm sitting back and thinking about it and talking about it, I'm kind of like, yeah, well, that's the end of that chapter. All right, so let's go into the voicemails.
Good day to you, rotoscopers. This is Danny once again. And if you guys are discussing The Road to El Dorado, then I'll happily share my thoughts. If I may be honest, I find this to be one of the most underrated animated films out there, as well as one that really deserves more love and respect. I love how beautiful looking this movie is. I love the friendship between Miguel and Tulio. The music is fantastic. I enjoy that the comedy in this film is more based on clever writing than traditional slapstick. And what I think I really admire most about this movie is how the movie sets it up as one of those liar revealed storylines, but it doesn't do any of that and instead comes up with something new and totally fresh. Anyway, hopefully more people will check out this movie in the near future. Did you know that this movie was directed by the same guy who did A Monster in Paris? Secondly, can we hear some Thunder Tube, Chelsea? It's been a while since we've heard it.
Hello, rotoscopers. This is Alex calling in to give my review of The Road to El Dorado. In 2000, DreamWorks Animation released 2 films. One of these films was amazing, but the other was forgettable. Unfortunately, El Dorado qualifies as the forgettable one. To be fair, there are some aspects of this film that I did enjoy. Some of the songs are good. The animation is excellent throughout, especially the character animation and the backgrounds. And I enjoyed the voice acting performances for the most part. Especially Jim Cummings' performance as Hernan Cortez. However, I feel that this film tries too hard to be funny. Most of the jokes fall flat, and I think that this film would have been more successful had the tone been more serious and dramatic. In addition, there's not much character development in the 2 leads. They are practically the same at the end as they are at the beginning. So overall, I give this film 2.5 stars. It's not terrible, but I do think it's one of DreamWorks' weaker films. Bye.
Oh my God, it's tough to be a god. Tread where mortals have not trod. Be deified when really you're a sham.
All right, guys, thank you for joining us for this episode of the Animation Addicts Podcast. It's been fun to go back and to review The Road to El Dorado. I don't think we were totally harsh on this film. There are good aspects of this film and there are bad, and I think we talked about them all. I'm really excited to hear what you guys have to say about this film. Rotoscopers.com/153. And again, a huge shout out to our patron, Jason, for picking this film. I'm very, very excited. If you would like to have your film reviewed on the show, go to rotoscopers.com/patron or rotoscopers.com/patreon to check out the perks of being a patron and how you can make that possible. And again, this show is made possible by patrons like you. Yay! You can also support the show by going to rotoscopers.com/Amazon and starting your Amazon shopping there. If you're like me, you're basically having an Amazon item, whether it's a 50-cent doodad or a bigger item. Every other day, it seems like you have a package on your doorstep. So one very simple, easy way to support the show is just to use that link. You can save it in your bookmarks bar and then just click it and then shop to your heart's content. We also, if you are in Canada, we have a very special affiliate link for our Canadian Amazonians. Go to rotoscopers.com/AmazonCA. And the only reason I mention that is because if we don't have anyone use that affiliate link in the next 90 days, they will shut our Amazon CA account down. So I think most people don't even know that exists. So if you're from Canada, check it out. All right, our next episode is going to be The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Finally.
This has been a long time coming.
There are so many that I'm like, how come we haven't done that yet?
Yeah, I'm really, really, really excited about this episode. So I want to hear from you guys. If you guys have any voicemails that you want to share, go to rotoscopers.com/voicemails, or you could dial 406-646-6575. If you're in the United States, leave us a voicemail. Let us know what you think about this one, because this is going to be, we're probably not going to be able to share all the voicemails that come through, because I just know that there's
going to be. This is going to have at least 10 voicemails. That is yeah. What is typically on these very popular and cult classic type movies, we get a lot of voicemails. So Chelsea, if the number is 6, what is your over under on how many voicemails we're going to get? Over or under 6?
I think we're going to get 9. Yeah, I think we're going to get 8 or 9, somewhere in there. But we're not going to be able to share all of them. So make sure that, you know, you get yours in fast and just like tell us what, you know, keep it at about a minute long or so. And then tell us why you love that film or whatever you want to say about it.
Yeah, make it unique, make it different. And that will increase your likelihood of getting it on the show. All right. So before we leave, we want to give a big thank you to everyone who has rated us in iTunes. That's really the simplest, easiest way to promote the show and to support the show. Go to rotoscopers.com/iTunes, and I'm going to read one of our 5-star reviews. The title says, "Great discussion of animation by Strange Animals Podcast. I don't always agree with the hosts on whether a particular movie is good or not," which Morgan's note, that's okay. I don't expect us to all have the same opinion. So
I appreciate that you don't.
Yes, I appreciate that we don't all think the same, because we're not all just mindless drones. But I always appreciate the discussion of why it did or didn't work for them. They really dig in to talk about not just what they liked, but how it fits with the larger picture of animation and pop culture in general. I also appreciate that they don't stick just one genre or type of animation. Thank you, Strange Animals Podcast.
Thank you.
I like that about the show, too. People say, I think sometimes we can be seen as the Disney show because of the patron picks. We do typically do a lot of Disney films. Yeah. And Disney has over 50 films at this point. DreamWorks is creeping up on them. But just out of the whole selection of animation, you know, they're one of the heaviest hitters. But the reason we named this show the Animation Addicts Podcast is because we like all forms of animation and a big variety of animation. And so we want to review it all. So we didn't want to pigeonhole ourselves in a corner. Instead, we pigeonholed ourselves into a slightly larger corner, which is animation in general. So thank you. And if you have a review, make sure to leave it and we will read it on the, and we will pick one on the next episode to read. Of course, you can find us on all things social media. We are on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, etc., etc. We are at Rotoscopers there. But I also have a fun new Instagram account that we've been doing. It's called Roto Disney, and it's all about things. Speaking of pigeonholing yourself into a corner, we are doing that. And this Instagram account is specifically focused on Disney because, as you would think, okay, the wide umbrella of animation, Disney is a subset. Disney actually is bigger than the whole animation.
Like, it really
is. In a weird way, the Disney fandom and community is so much bigger than the animation specific community.
Yeah.
And it's very much a phenomenon. So we have this Instagram account just to highlight different things of the parks, movies, cosplay, characters, whatever. If you have photographs that you want to get featured on our account, use the hashtag RotoDisney on Instagram and we might pick your photo to be featured. So anyways, just wanted to plug that. It's been really fun to do. I've been kind of focusing it around color schemes. So I'll do a bunch of photos that are all in the pinks and now I've moved on to the oranges.
I like your artistic choices.
I'm going to go
here.
Into blues. I don't know. It's just fun for me to like find good nuggets on the internet for that particular color that I'm looking for.
Yeah. You can also find us individually. You've got Morgan Stradling on all things social media and Chelsea Robson on all things social media. So reach out. We like to talk to you guys.
All right, guys. That's all we have for this episode of the Animation Addicts podcast. Until next time, we are the Rotoscopers.
Yay.
I thought you were going to do the...